This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You may have heard of the experimental Ebola drug ZMapp. We have talked about it. And we've talked about how it's really not easy to make lots of it. And one of the reasons is that the drug is not produced in a factory, but in a greenhouse. ZMapp is created in the leaves of tobacco plants. And you have to grow all those tobacco plants. In the brave new world of biotechnology and synthetic biology, scientists are programming plants and other organisms like engineers designing circuits for computers and smartphones. What can this biological engineering open up? Christopher Voigt is a professor of biological engineering at MIT in Boston. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thanks for having me on.
So you really are engineers when we talk about synthetic biology?
Oh, yes. And they're all types of engineers. So I'm a chemical engineer, but we have bioengineers, mechanical engineers, civil engineers, electrical engineers. Just about everybody's contributing that you can think of.
So I you know, having sort of an engineering and electronics background myself, I understand what those mechanical electrical engineers are doing, but I'm not quite sure what you're doing in the field of biology. Can you describe synthetic biology engineering for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So the term has been around for about 100 years, but modern genetic engineering really started in the 70s and was really about doing very simple things to cells, like putting in single genes or trying to evolve them to do something a little better. Synthetic biology really grew in the last decade because the cost of chemically synthesizing DNA declined dramatically. And then this brought on board a number of new design tools that are allowing us to really build much larger things and much more sophisticated genetic engineering projects.
You mean more sophisticated than DNA?
Exactly. So more sophisticated in the ambition of what we would like to put in there. So instead of a single gene, we might want to really be able to access what biology can do. And when you look at a plant, you look at all of the sophisticated structures that are in there, we're still only at the very early stages of really understanding how we could build artificially structures of that complexity.
When you say artificial structures, are you saying from the parts of the synthetic DNA itself, you make all those parts yourself synthetically?
Right. Well, you can think of genetics as, so for example, you might say, well, I have good genes or whatever. Everything that you see in a biological system can be mapped down to the DNA. And so if you see that plants are green and have a certain structure or produce certain chemicals, all of those different features map eventually down to the DNA sequence. And so one of the real insights of synthetic biology is rather than seeing the genome as this continuous whole, trying to break those functions down into parts in the same way that we might have screws in mechanical engineering or circuits in electrical engineering, and be able to characterize those little pieces of DNA so that we could get better at figuring out how to put them together to build really new things.
Mm-hmm. Our number, 844-724-8255. If you'd like to talk about synthetic biology, 844-SCI-TALK. Is it easier to work with biology than it is with electrical circuits?
No, biology is sort of one of the most difficult things we can do right now. I mean, even putting in very simple functions is a challenge. We've created in my lab a programming language that helps us build electronic-like circuit functions in cells. And we can only encode maybe 10 or 12 lines of code into the DNA. So compared to a computer, that's quite small.
Tell me, the
difference is that we can control biology then.
Well, let's talk about what do you mean you can code 10 or 12 lines into the DNA? It's like mind-boggling.
Yeah, it's sometimes hard to imagine how individual cells can do computation, but they're doing it all the time. So even an individual bacterium, it's constantly looking around its surroundings. It has sensors. It's thinking. It doesn't have neurons, but it's doing that thinking through molecular interactions, so interactions between the different proteins in the DNA. And those interactions produce computation-like responses. So you can say, you know, if I'm cold and there's a lot of salt around, I might want to do one thing. And so that's a simple computational function. And so what we're trying to do is to go the other direction, say, instead of just trying to understand naturally what the cells are doing, we want to write down the computation we want and then figure out how to put the pieces of DNA in order to create that that computation into the cell.
So that the cells make things for you, like as if you were, as you say, you were programming a computer.
Yeah, exactly. So the output then becomes the thing that the biology can do. So if you had a plant that you were trying to make it resistant to low temperatures, you could say, well, the program would be if cold, then produce that protein. Mm. And so that's a very simple sort of sense and respond, but that's moving towards this notion of biology as being something that's smart. And so you can imagine a smart plant as being able to sit in a field and receive information about its environment and then compute what it should be doing based on what it sees.
And once you change the cell that way, does it reproduce and produce more of the modified cell, the engineered cell?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's the fun part about it. You only have to make one little piece of DNA containing that program, and then you put it in your bacterium or whatever cell type you're working with, and then it grows up, and it keeps reproducing your program as well as everything else in the cell. And it's just running that program in the background while it's doing all of its own natural things associated with living and dividing and eating and all the other things that biology does.
Wow, amazing. Let me bring on Stephen Streatfeild. He is Associate Editor of the Plant Biotechnology Journal and Director of Research and Development Scientific Affairs at the Fraunhofer USA Center for Molecular Biotechnology in Newark, Delaware. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira. Thank you. Pleased to be here.
Let's talk about, I know you were not on the team that created ZMapp, but you do work with using plants to produce drugs. We've been talking about this a little bit with Dr. Voigt. Tell us how a plant can be engineered to produce a drug that would, for example, combat Ebola.
Well, there's two main ways that are used. One is making transgenic plants, and the other one is using a trans expression system, where the plants are grown pretty much to maturity, and then agrobacteria, which is a natural pathogen of plant systems, are engineered and introduced into those plants, and they drive the expression of a foreign protein in the plant tissues. So we grow plants to about 5 weeks of age, introduce the agrobacterium, which is carrying some genetic machinery from agrobacterial genes or plant viral genes, and then they're launched into the plant cells and they drive expression of recombinant protein. So, for example, in the ZMapp case, there's three different antibodies that are being produced in different plant lines, and they're produced in the plant cells, harvested, purified, and then a drug developed from that.
So how many leaves does it take to produce a dose of the drug?
Well, you typically, these plants are used when they're fairly small. So you get about a milligram of protein from a single plant. And then the number of doses is really dependent on whether it's a vaccine or an antibody. For an antibody, you need up to about a half a gram per dose. So it can be as many as about 500 plants needed.
For one dose? Wow.
For an antibody, it's very different. You get a single dose. You get many doses, tens of doses from a single plant. Mm. So depending on the application of the therapeutic or vaccine, depends on the number of plants needed.
What's the advantage of a plant system for producing these drugs? Could you not talk an algae into making it for you?
Yeah, absolutely. There are many rival systems, essentially, and they tend to be tested with different targets and tried out for whichever suits best for that target. So plant systems have proved to be fairly good for generally eukaryotic proteins. Proteins that are from mammals, mice, humans, this sort of thing, and the general machinery in a plant system for the protein production and modification is fairly similar to what you see in a mammalian system, and that's been a system of choice recently for a number of different targets. Mm-hmm. But absolutely, you can make recombinant proteins in microbial systems successfully. There are sometimes difficulties though in folding in high levels of production of a target using a microbial system.
It's I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about it, that it's not just big university labs and research centers that are working on synthetic biology. I want to bring on another guest. He's a member of the winning team from the iGEM competition. That is an international student synthetic biology competition. Aaron Cohen is a member of the grand prize winning team, the University of California, Davis. He's also an undergraduate student in biomedical engineering there. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira. Thanks for having me.
Tell us about what your winning project was.
Well, we focused on something a little different than Mr. Voigt was discussing, and that's enzyme engineering. So we wanted to detect rancidity in olive oil specifically. We've heard that there's some issues with quality control in that industry, and we thought we could help.
And so you set out to find a way of testing. Is that a big problem with rancidity in olive oil?
It certainly is. The UC Davis Olive Center found out that about 70% of the olive oil in America is actually rancid by the time you purchase it.
Well, that's a separate story for us. So
yeah.
Look into that. And so it would be great to have a very simple way to test the rancidity of the oil, whether what's coming out of your bottle is rancid or not. You created an enzyme that you used to determine whether or not the olive oil was rancid?
Yeah, we actually created multiple enzymes. So we used some powerful computer software to change some of the genetic code that Dr. Voigt was discussing so that we could change the specificity of the enzyme, meaning get it to respond to a little different chemicals than it normally does. Mm-hmm. And we use that engineered enzyme to then detect different levels of aldehydes present in olive oil. And this was an indicator of rancidity. And we were able to use this whole system to basically spot the fake stuff, spot the bad stuff.
Is it like a little spot test? Could you just put a drop of oil on it and see if...
It's a little more complicated than that. You actually have to dilute the oil down so you bring it from an oil into a liquid phase, or an aqueous phase, rather. Mm-hmm. So you do a little extraction, and then you basically, you just put it on an electrode, and you run some electricity through it, and you record the current, and you're able to determine the rancidity level.
Well, as somebody who uses a lot of olive oil, I'm waiting for that home test that you're going to come up. We could just drop that little bit of oil. And you were very successful in your test, right? It worked out very well.
Yeah, we were able to detect, we had 9 samples, and we got 8 of the 9 correct. You know, we're still working on teasing out that last one, but ultimately, we were able to pull the rancid ones out, which is really an accomplishment considering how complex the chemistry is in olive oil, and there's really no other method of performing this test.
So I imagine you must be commercializing this by now.
That's the plan.
To make the money. Well, good luck to you, Aaron. Thanks for stopping by Science Friday.
Yeah, thank you for having me on. All right.
Aaron Cohen, a member of the grand prize-winning University of California UC Davis iGEM team. We'll see what happens with his test. I'm Ira Flato. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Also talking with Aaron Cohen and Christopher Voigt. What did you think, Christopher?
Oh, that was a fantastic project that they had as part of that competition. And, it's really interesting because in something that seems so simple to a human, like whether a food is rancid or not rancid, that turns into a really difficult chemical problem because there are a lot of different chemistries that are involved. And so I think they were very clever about figuring out how to build the circuitry that can take all of those chemicals and then turn that into a human-like response, like this is rancid or not.
Stephen, could some of these synthetic biology systems help in your work?
Yes, there's a number of developments recently of modifying the host plant. So you rather than starting with a wild type tobacco plant, you can engineer that tobacco plant so that you modify the glycosylation, for example, of the protein that's being produced. And a number of complex traits can be introduced into these plants to greatly affect the nature of the recombinant protein that's being introduced and produced.
What's so great about tobacco plants? What about other plants that might be used?
Well, the technology conceptually is applicable to any number of plants, but it's largely been developed using tobacco and relatives of tobacco. They've kind of model plant systems that have been worked on for many years, very susceptible to the plant viral machineries that are often used to express and produce the large amounts of these proteins. and very susceptible to the transformation techniques, introducing these vectors into the plants. The other thing is they generate biomass fairly rapidly. So in a matter of a few weeks, you can go from just really pinhead-sized seeds to plants several inches tall with a fair amount of leafy biomass that can produce a protein. So they're very amenable to the production technologies.
Christopher Voigt, do you think you could come up with a better synthetic biology system than using a full-scale plant?
Well, plants are fantastic as manufacturing platforms. At the beginning of your intro, you said, you know, it's not a factory that's making the drug. It's a field of crops. But in reality, that field of crops to us really looks like a manufacturing process. So when you think of all the complex things that you could have a plant do, it's pretty incredible.
All right, cool.
I think the downside with it is that plant engineering is still very slow. So it can take years to develop one of these plants. And then the actual production of the material takes a growing cycle. And so there are some companies out there that are looking at alternative approaches to producing vaccines for things like Ebola. So there's a partnership between Novartis and Synthetic Genomics, for example, that has the delivery of a vaccine to a new flu down to 8 days. And so this is a remarkable use of synthetic biology to just take the genome of a new viral threat and based on that, turn that into a vaccine in a very short period of time so that it can be delivered very rapidly as part of a response.
Is some of the problem is that they're not the same kind of viruses, Ebola and the flu, that you can't do it that quickly?
Well, all viruses evolve. Flu has been particularly bad in that it evolves so quickly that we're always trying to keep one step ahead of it, and that's why you have to take a flu shot every year. All viruses, Ebola also is evolving very rapidly. And in this particular epidemic, they've been watching how it evolves and how the mutations that are occurring can actually impact the ability of the vaccine and diagnostics to be able to detect and fight this epidemic. But it's really new data that's being generated as part of this current crisis. But
right.
For whatever... Sorry.
We've run out of time. This is fascinating. Thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome. Christopher Voigt, Professor of Biological Engineering at MIT. Stephen Streatfield, Associate Editor of Plant Biotechnology Journal and Director of Research and Development at the Scientific Affairs at Fraunhofer USA Center for Molecular Biotechnology in Newark, Delaware. Thanks for being with us today. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back after this. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI.